Good afternoon. I'm so used to starting the board meeting in the mornings. Good afternoon. I'm already here as chair of the Montgomery County Planning Board, and we're starting our board meeting for November 9th. October 9th. So totally confused today. Yeah. Our first item is 1A, adoption of resolutions. We have two this morning. Commissioner Bartley and Vice Chair Pettum aren't allowed to vote on these two. The first one is resurvey on locus level preliminary plan amendment, and the second is resurface on local locus level forest conservation plan. Do I have a motion for approval of these two resolutions?
Move to approve.
Commissioner Hedrick, could you second the adoption of the two resolutions, please?
Second. My apologies. I got cut off there for a second. Starting to log back.
Okay. All
wonders of technology. Sorry, everybody.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Aye. The ayes have it. The 3-0-2. Okay. Good. All right. So the next item is adoption of, the next one is the Viva White Oak Provisional Adequate Public Facilities for Development District, where all commissioners can vote. Do I have a motion for approval of that resolution, which is Viva White Oak Provisional Adequate Public Facilities for Development District?
I move for approval of Viva White Oak Provisional Adequate Public Facilities.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 The ayes have it, 5-0. The next item is approval of minutes, the minutes of September 22nd board meeting, where all commissioners are eligible to vote. Do I have a motion for approval of the September 22nd minutes?
I move for approval of the minutes of September 22nd.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it, 5-0. And next we have item 1C, selection of vice chair. So every year, the vice chair has an appointment of 1 year, and we have such a strong and experienced board, and I'm so delighted for the past 2 years that Commissioner Pettawim has been the vice chair, and this year we're going to, I've always been my goal to, because we have such a strong board, to rotate the vice chair position. So I'm grateful for you again for your vice chair position over the past 2 years, and I would like a nomination of Josh Linden as our new vice chair.
I have to move first. Let me do my write-up in here, Commissioner Bartley. I'm delighted to move to nominate Commissioner Joshua Linden to be the next vice chair, and I happily turn over the baton to Commissioner Linden for next year.
I second.
I will second.
Oh, we have multiple seconds here. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. It's unanimous.
And I believe it's starting from, I say that either today or next Thursday. I don't know how it works. Doesn't matter.
Start today.
Okay. Congratulations, Commissioner Linden. Welcome aboard as
Thank
vice
you.
Chair.
Thank you. And.
That's my
Just wanted to say thanks to the chair and to Mitra for serving in the role for 2 years, I guess, two full years, and everyone on the board and all staff as well for being such collaborative colleagues. Just look forward to the next year.
Thank you. So we'll go to item number 3, regulatory extension requests. We have two this afternoon. The first one is College View Campus Preliminary Plan Extension Request Number 3, and the second is Temple Row Administrative Subdivision Plan and Forest Conservation Plan Extension Request Number 3. Also, both staffers recommending approval of these extension requests. Do I have a motion for approval of these two?
I move for the approval of the two regulatory extension requests as mentioned by Chair Harris.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it 5-0. And next we will have our roundtable discussion by our Parks Director, Mitty Figueredo. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Harris. So starting out, this was our Parks Ale Trail. It's always at Lake Needwood. And it's an event that's put on by our activation team. They get support from the Northern Region, from facilities management, of course, program access, making sure that everybody has the ability to participate in this event, and a number of other Parks Department divisions. This year, we doubled our attendance over last year. We had 8,000 people attending. The year before, we had 4,000. We had 8 breweries there, 11 food trucks. I think we're steadily trying to bring the number of food trucks at these kinds of events up to keep up with the demand. We had a bunch of entertainment. We had roving entertainers, including apparently a stilt walker. I'm sorry, I missed that. And a couple of stages with a main band and an acoustic musician. And I think everybody had a really great time, and there was lovely weather.
Do you get the beer license or alcohol license for these events?
Yes. Yes.
For every single of them? Or can we get?
For our events, yes, we get an alcohol permit from the county for the event. I sign off on the permits.
I was wondering that we could get a blanket permit that you don't have to sign so many different ones. I don't know if it's possible or not.
You know, I haven't had a recent refresher on how we're doing our alcohol events, but you know what? It's working pretty well. I don't think it's a cumbersome system for us. Yeah. Some of you, or maybe all of you, are familiar with Cassandra Michaud. She may have presented to you in the past, but she is our Cultural Resources Stewardship Section Supervisor. She gave the keynote address at the 34th Annual Workshop in Archaeology that is held by the Maryland Historical Trust. And she talked about 3 different parks projects: Josiah Henson, the educational programs that we're doing at Royce Hanson Conservation Park in partnership with Poolsville High School's Global Ecology Program, and our current research and future plans at the Edner Soapstone Quarry Park, which you're all familiar with because I think this board approved the purchase of that property. Also awarded $10,000 by the African American Heritage Preservation Program. That's another program that's administered by the Maryland Historical Trust. And with this funding, we conducted a ground penetrating radar survey at Montgomery Chapel Cemetery in Little Bennett Park, and we also used some for some interpretive signage. We knew that there were 39 existing grave markers at the site, but with the ground penetrating radar, we were able to identify 104 unmarked graves and some additional features that indicate to us that there may be even more burials at the site. We think it might be as high as 172. So we're extending the boundary of the cemetery to incorporate all the newly identified locations so we can make sure that we are properly maintaining and stewarding this historic cemetery. The survey also, we were able to identify the foundation of the former Montgomery Chapel building. We've also hired a cemetery conservator to repair and put upright and conserve some markers at Cook Family Cemetery. I think that's the picture you can see there on the right, and at Montgomery Chapel. And yes, that's the work in progress.
Where's it located exactly?
Where's Cook Chapel or the
cemetery?
I'll have to get you that location. I can get you. We have all our cemeteries. I will tell you that all of our cemeteries are mapped and in GIS. I think we have something like 13 or 15 cemeteries on parkland that we steward. I don't know where this one is located. I can send you the map.
The reason why I was asking is we stumbled across a cemetery in a neighborhood near where the new Frisbee Park is going to be, and it was really cool to see it was there.
Yeah. Okay. So. Yes. Yeah. And I'll definitely get you more information on that. And thanks to a volunteer group from Warner Brothers Discovery, we were able to plant a new Kwanzaa cherry grove at Brookside Gardens. 14 volunteers and our gardens team planted 24 trees in one morning. So next time you're at the Goody Garden, those plantings are near Shorefield. The trees came from Stadler Nursery in Laytonsville. You know, most of the trees and plants we use in parks come from Pope Farm, but we don't grow every single thing. So we acquired these trees from Stadler. They're local. We try to purchase locally as much as possible.
Is the vision in the bottom right, is that the vision, the future vision?
Yeah, that's not them now. I think that's what they're going to look like. You can see them now. They're baby trees in the main picture.
Yeah.
But ideally, one day, they will look like Kenwood or, you know, DC's cherry trees. It was Active Aging Week at the beginning of October, and our program access team celebrated Walk Maryland Day, and we had over 100 walkers, 55 and over, joining us. Apparently, I did not know this, walking is our state's official exercise, and so the event is a call to action to support safe walking and walkable places. At the end of the 3.5-mile trek, which was through Wheaton Regional and Brookside, the participants had lunch and there was a DJ and they basically socialized and had a nice time. So I also want to thank the sponsors who supported this event, the Law Office of Brian Gormley, the LF Law Group, and the Juanita C. Grant Foundation. So thanks to them. And also celebrating Active Aging Week on Monday, October 6th, Montgomery County agencies came together for an event called Go, Grow, and Get Active. That was at the North Potomac Community Rec Center and was attended by over 300 people. We had activities there like Nature on Wheels, and staff from Woodlawn Manor Cultural Park shared a historical account of the freedom seekers in Montgomery County. And speaking of museums, they are participating in Banned Book Week, which was October 5th through October 11th. And our staff held read-ins at Josiah Henson and Oakley Cabin, African-American Museum and Park. Banned Book Week launched in 1982 in response to what at the time was a surge in book challenges in libraries and schools. Seems like this kind of event's more relevant than ever. Some of the books they were reading are Beloved by Toni Morrison, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, The Color Purple by Alice Walker, and more. 14th Annual Urban Tree Summit was on September 17th at the Silver Spring Civic Building. And as always, it brought together leaders in urban forestry and conservation for a day of learning and collaboration. This event is coordinated through a long-standing partnership between Montgomery Parks and Casey Trees, and it features a lineup of speakers that include researchers and policy experts and community advocates, and they're all coming together to explore strategies for how you build climate-resilient urban forests and advance environmental equity. We issued a call for artists to paint a mural at the Glenmont Park Activity Building. That's just a rendering. The mural's not up yet. A jury narrowed the applications that we received to four artists who prepared concepts for public voting. That voting happened in August. It generated over 2,500 votes, and then there was a runoff. The winner was announced on September 18th, and that's an image of the winning artwork. It's called Rooted and Radiant. The design is by Red Swan, which is a Baltimore-based mural studio run by artists Hannah Moran and Lindy Swan, and they created the mural to celebrate Glenmont's diversity by bringing together plants and animals from Latin America and Maryland to celebrate sort of the diversity of that area, and it's going to really beautify that building. The unveiling of the mural will happen in November, and I also want to thank our staff, Samantha Schroen from our Park Development Division, who had the concept and idea for this, and to the Montgomery Parks Foundation, who gave us the funding for it. Regional Parks Enterprise Facilities are hosting a community day. If you buy a ticket, you get a passport to attend events at the Wheaton Ice Arena, Wheaton Indoor Tennis, and the Wheaton Sports Pavilion. And that ticket includes skate rental and tennis rackets. Every facility is going to have a schedule of events with program information, and participants who fill up their passports will be entered to win prizes. Had our Harvest Festival. We had about 1,700 attendees. They come to Ag History Farm Park and engage in hands-on historic and autumn-themed family activities. Some of these include candle dipping, you get to paint pumpkins, build scarecrows, there's live music, we have really adorable farm animals there to admire, and our park police mounted patrol and canine demonstrations were there as well. I wasn't able to attend this year, but if you get the chance to go next year, there's some pretty cool stuff going on. And so I previewed this at the council semi-annual report on Tuesday, but I don't know, maybe like a month or two ago, Andrew Friedson's office sent a constituent along our way who let us know that she thought that the historic Porky Pig at Cabin John was, you know, kind of in a little bit of a deplorable condition. And you can see him there on the left, you know, he's at that point seen better days. And, you know, she asked, like, is there something, this is a beloved community amenity. I mean, generations of children have been terrified and delighted by this pig. It depends on the kid. The reaction's very kid dependent. But, you know, she asked, could we do something to restore this, you know, beloved thing? And our facilities management team, our exhibit shop, they just really stepped up. They took the pig and brought it back to their shop and lovingly restored and hand-painted this pig. I got to see some of the pictures of the restoration while it was underway, and it was amazing. I want to particularly give kudos to Jasper Dudley from the exhibit shop. He took the lead on the project. He made sure every detail was perfect. And you can see how gorgeous this pig looks now. And they had to fix, it's an electrical pig, so like it makes a noise. And the noise was not good. The noise was really kind of contributing to the sort of, you know, scariness of the pig. And so anyway, the whole thing has been fully refurbished to, again, both delight and terrify future generations of children who visit Cabin John Regional Park. And I am unreasonably delighted by this, as you can see. Just our closing slide, that's a picture of our fall festival. The chair attended it with me. We had over 500 parks employees. You know, we're a decent sized department, so it's hard to get all of the employees in one place at one time. This was a really good showing. And it was a lovely event. It's, you know, it's a team building event, but also it's an opportunity for staff to learn about the work across the departments, that all the divisions. So we had stations where different divisions were talking about the work they do, and there was a lunch, and I think everyone had a wonderful time, and it was a great event. I want to especially thank Deputy Director Gary Burnett for really spearheading this and making sure it happens. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your presentation. It's always great to see many of the recent events that the parks put on. And what I love about it is, you know, you touch so many generations of folks, you know, from the little kids to the adults, and you have activities for all. And that's what's so needed in our county. And so thank you for doing that. And I was able to go to the festival, and it was just so sitting down and talking to many of the folks that work with parks and see them enjoy themselves. This was a day, like, you know, they're working for others in every day of the week, and this is a day that they got to enjoy themselves. So thank you for putting that on. And you also had a flu shot station, so I was able to get, I heard, you know, maybe over 100 people got flu shots too. So it was
got one too.
Yep, all good. So thank you for that. And it was great. Congratulations, Sandra, Michaud, and to learn about all the stuff we do around archaeology. So thank you. Any other comments, questions from the board?
just to say, as a dad of a kid who has been terrified of that pig, I'm really appreciative of that. I think she was mostly afraid of it because she didn't fully understand what it was, because it was kind of hard to tell in the shape that it was. So anyway, that's great to hear. And also, I just, you know, demonstrates the great capacity that you all have internally to do these kinds of things, which is incredible and I think somewhat rare when it comes to departments like this. So thanks to your team.
I was terrified of that.
Yeah. So thank you again. Thanks to the park staff for all your great work. We're going to take a 2-minute break and start with our next item, item number 6, ZTA 2512, overlay zones, University Boulevard overlay zone, where staff is recommending that the board transmit comments to the district county council. Thank you. Good afternoon. We're on item number 6, ZTA 25-12, overlay zones, University Boulevard overlay zone, where staff is recommending that the planning board transmit comments to the district council. And this afternoon, we have Ben Berbert with the planning department presenting this item. Welcome, Mr. Berbert.
For the record, I am Ben Berbert with the Design, Placemaking, and Policy Division, and I am bringing forth ZTA 2512, the overlay zone for University Boulevard. Staff is recommending the board support this overlay zone with a couple of minor revisions that I will discuss. This ZTA creates a new overlay zone for University Boulevard, implementing some of the land use and zoning recommendations that have come out of the planning board's draft of the University Boulevard corridor plan. Some background, you have seen this before. You saw it back in June of this year. It was transmitted to council right after the actual corridor plan was transmitted. They are sort of meant to be reviewed together by council, and that is sort of the intent council has taken up at PHP, the start of the review of the corridor plan. This is going to get to them right at the end of that, so that whatever comes of the corridor plan's recommendations can then be modified through them modifying this overlay zone. Part of that is also sort of my primer, that we are just bringing forward what you proposed. We are recommending you go ahead and keep that line the same, even though there has been some meetings with council and things might change, they might not, it's undecided. And so at this point, we're sticking with the board's draft of the plan and its implementation of it. And so, you know, this really should just be a pretty simple discussion we're gonna walk through here.
So if through the reviews of the council, the UBC plan changes and some of these requirements change, it's gonna come back?
No, so if the council decides they wanna make changes to this zoning text amendment, it would follow the way any change happens. It would just be a change made at either PHP or full council, depending on whether the committee makes a change or whether full council does, but they will not reinvolve the planning board. Now, they'll reinvolve planning staff more than likely. We are at these meetings, but it will not actually come back before the board again.
I understand, but the ZTA would be, this ZTA would be revised by council staff for council approval.
Correct. It could be revised to mirror whatever the plan recommendations
to mirror the plan. Okay, got it. Thanks. So that may not be the final.
Correct. You know, one of the things that's come up a lot is the comparison of the University Boulevard overlay zone and what it's intending to do in comparison to the More Housing Now policy that passed earlier this summer. They're very similar in a lot of ways what they're trying to achieve. It's trying to achieve more housing in areas that we think more housing is appropriate. The primary differences are sort of the path it's taking. In the University Boulevard plan and through the overlay zone, it's an actual rezoning of the properties to the CRN zone, and then going back with the overlay zone to apply standards to create the compatibility and sort of protection of the existing neighborhood. The More Housing Now package sort of kept the underlying residential zone and has sort of added additional provisions that can be done, but they really do kind of meet in a very similar place. Similar building types are allowed, focusing on duplex, triplex, townhouse, trying to keep some of the similar residential standards, such as the lot coverage and height, very similar. Really the primary difference is just how we're getting there. The other primary difference is we did a master plan here, and we've spent a long time engaging with the community, looking at our infrastructure, looking at the resources that are available, looking at the natural environment, and came up with recommendations that we thought were appropriate for this area, which is also why the recommendations are a little more intense. You know, More Housing Now really was done at a countywide level, and so the countywide level came up with a much smaller, narrower geography that was applicable to it, knowing that we didn't have the benefit of doing a very detailed master plan in each one of these locations yet. And so that's really the main reason why we're supportive of the overlay zone as part of the plan being more expansive than what the More Housing Now has already passed, and why we're still sticking with that recommendation.
Can I ask a question about that? Because the more, for example, I just want to make sure that that's how it works, was applying to the houses that they were facing to the University Boulevard, correct? And they had to be adjacent to University Boulevard.
If
that was under the More Now.
Correct. The More Housing Now is certain roadways have applicable properties, and it is properties that do have their frontage on
just
the roadway.
Those. But under this overlay zoning plan, it's not going to be, it's going to have that and more, because it's going to extend to the block.
Correct.
And so the requirement of being facing to University Boulevard is taken. It's going to be overruled by overlay zone. Is that correct?
It would be, but it would be because More Housing Now applies only to the residential detached zones. We have recommended rezoning these properties CRN. And so if they are rezoned CRN, More Housing Now is actually no longer applicable. So it's there's sort of like a two-step process. But the properties that we are recommending rezoning to CRN through the corridor plan are, it's the full block. It's not just the properties that actually face University Boulevard.
Okay, and so because the zoning is changed, so those requirements that they had to be faced University Boulevard is taken away, correct, because of the zoning change?
Yes, under the planning board draft, that requirement to actually front the corridor would go away. And in exchange, any property that we recommended being rezoned to CRN would be eligible for these new building types.
Got it. Thank you.
Quickly running through the sections of the overlay zone. First is the purpose section, purpose being to increase the diversity and supply of housing in a compact transit-oriented form of growth that supports bus rapid transit on University Boulevard and Colesville Road, creates complete communities, and improves safety for all travelers. Again, this was a definition that was discussed back when we were requesting introduction, and this is what we agreed to at that time. In the land use section, it's broken into a couple of sections, one for properties that are just zoned CRN, and there are some other recommendations that apply to the entirety of the overlay zone. For those properties that are just zoned CRN, a couple of the changes here were really intended to continue some of what was allowed in the residential detached zones, such as allowing accessory dwelling units as an allowed use if it is a single-family detached home on the lot. And also the provision that we've talked about before that continues any of the non-residential uses that were in the residential zone that were allowed by conditional use could still apply to these CRN zone properties, even though we are otherwise mapping commercial at zero, because we didn't want generally commercial to be allowed. Again, the CRN zone allows a lot more commercial uses than the R60 and R90 zones did. Looking at the entire overlay zone under the land use section, there's a list of uses that we are recommending that the new instances would be prohibited, and that the existing uses would become legal nonconforming. Again, these were all sort of deemed to be auto-centric uses that didn't fit with the vision of the plan, including vehicle sales and service, car washes, filling stations, vehicle repair, drive-throughs, certain manufacturing and production, self-storage and storage facility. Again, this is another one of those lists that we actually amended as part of our session with you guys back in June. The two changes that we are recommending are in the development standards section of the overlay zone. Again, this is sort of a series of development standard modifications, mostly that are trying to get at that sort of house scale development that we were hoping to achieve with our attached units. The first modification is to specify when we said that the CRN duplex standards should apply to all building types. There's actually a side and an over, and they have slightly different standards for a couple of them. So we're just deciding to clarify that it should be duplex side that is being used. The other change, and this is actually being done to be consistent with More Housing Now and the way we realized coverage works, rather than having lot coverage limitations, we're doing site coverage. Again, if you're picturing an existing lot that's being subdivided into three smaller lots for a triplex, what really matters is it's 35% of that existing site that is being covered. You might have coverage variations across the different resulting lots. So this just provides that flexibility. And then the other standards are remaining as introduced. One entrance at minimum needs to abut a street. Parking needs to be behind the front building line. And because these sites are so small, we're not requiring the public open space requirement apply.
Mr. Berwick, yeah, thank you. Could you go over what is a side? Side versus a built an over, so we can all understand that,
Sure. So in the zoning ordinance, in some of the zones, specifies duplex side versus duplex over. They are both buildings that have two dwelling units in them. For the side, the best way I could say is think of it as a two-unit townhouse. The party wall that separates these units is a vertical wall. You have the two units side by side. They're generally subdivided, so you have that lot line running down the middle. Think of all the duplexes that are just up Veers Mill Road, you know, a mile up on the right. Those are all duplex sides. They have the side separation. The code also does contemplate you could have duplex over or a stacked unit in a more urban form. The primary difference is in the duplex over, you actually need a larger lot size because you don't subdivide. And it creates a that was the primary difference, really, was the lot size.
That's wonderful. I've got it now, yeah. Yeah, thank you for that.
I have another question. This is for under 15,000 square foot. In your report, you had said that they're required to have parking to be screened. Parking? One of the requirement, and I was wondering, what does that mean? In their driveways, how could they screen it? Under development waiving the open space requirement, and then you had said parking screened.
So what we did, and again, trying to keep in mind compatibility, normally parking lots are not a feature of these residential zones, and we've made some changes in the code already, such as allowing ADUs to remain or allowing the conditional uses that are commercial to remain. Create small parking lot facilities if you're having a triplex unit that has to have all of its parking in behind. There are certain standards that apply for parking for conditional uses. That was the closest approximate we could come up with, that if it's a certain number of parking spaces or more, and I apologize, I don't have that number at the tip of my tongue, what the threshold is, that you have to meet parking lot screening requirements. And it basically requires that there might be a landscaping element that has to go around the perimeter of that parking area.
What do you mean by parking lot? I didn't see parking lot. If it is parking lot, I understand. I thought this is a screened parking. If I was wondering if it is one or two or three cars that are in the driveway or somewhere, how could they screen it? But if it is that they use the land for parking lot and put, you know, I just don't see how they use on a small 15,000 square foot to put the house and put the parking lot. I just don't see how it's possible.
I'm not the design expert that can explain how I've seen the drawings that show potential for small parking lots in the backyards of these buildings, but we've seen them. If it's just an access drive and it goes into an integrated garage that maybe that side loads off of these buildings, there wouldn't be a screening requirement because that's not something, and it really relies on what the standards are for the conditional use screening. Those do envision actual parking lots with marked spaces, and that's what we're trying to screen from.
Okay, so parking lot is something that has multiple cars, maybe 4, 5, 6, huh? One or two or three is not. I don't know how we define parking lot. That's the question.
Commissioner Padaway, it references 6.2.9.B of the code, which applies to conditional uses requiring 5 to 9 spaces. So it would be 5 to 9 spaces.
That makes sense. Thank you. Now it makes sense. Okay.
Getting into the development standards for sites that are CRN zoned but are larger than 15,000 square feet, either because the existing lot is larger or because there's been consolidation. Again, the standards would just follow that for the building type of the underlying zone at that point. The changes that are recommended through the overlay zone would actually reduce the build-to area, which is the amount of building that needs to be a certain distance from the road. Right now, the duplex standard, I believe it's up to 30 feet back. We recommended reducing that to 10 feet just so we can start creating that building edge. And again, continuing that requirement that parking be located behind the front building line.
Sorry.
I have a question.
Yeah, you go
about,
first.
About 10-foot minimum setbacks to the street. I refer to this because I'm a big fan of the pedestrian master plan, and I always praise Eli for the great work he did in this. And I don't see how this jibes with the pedestrian master plan and creating safe walkways and spaces for citizens, having a minimum 10-foot setback. I would think that the setback would have to be greater than 10 feet from a street.
So the premise, I guess there's twofold. And again, I'm not an urban designer, but I've heard enough of this that I can at least start the conversation. One, by pulling the buildings a little closer to the street and creating that presence, and I think we've all driven in a slightly more dense feeling neighborhood where the buildings are closer to the street, it tends to start slowing traffic down just because you are sort of feeling like you're in a little bit more of a confined space. And so by slowing the vehicle traffic down slightly, you start making the whole environment safer for bikes and pedestrians as a whole. I think the other thing to think about here is having these sort of uses, the windows, the doors closer to the street, there's a little more presence, there's a little more activation, there's a little more eyes on the street to also try to provide some of that level of safety. In the situation we have now where the buildings are set back 30 or 40 feet, yes, you have a little more green space, but you also can create that sense that it's more open in an environment, and it might make it a little more likely for people to be speeding or stuff like that to happen. I think the other thing to keep in mind in all of this is that 10-foot setback starts from the property line. There may be additional right-of-way dedication that would happen as part of any plan that you have and rebuilding the sidewalk. All of this moves further away from the street as it is. The building has to then move 10 more feet back from that location. It might not actually bring the buildings substantially closer to University Boulevard, but it puts them sort of, once the streetscape is fully implemented, in the place that everything wants to be to achieve this vision. And so that's the other thing to kind of keep in mind is you have the street, you have the green buffer, you have a wider sidewalk. This additional 10 feet is another area of green space between that sidewalk and where the building starts now.
Could you explain where is exactly this 10 feet measures from? I know you had told me that one time. I have forgotten. I don't understand build to area setback to 10 feet minimum. What does that mean? Is that the front of the building to the property line, 10 foot?
Build to area, I think of it as a maximum setback. If you look at what the way the code defines it, is it says that 70% of the facade of the front facade of the building has to be within the build to area. And so by setting a build to area of 10 feet, it means that 70% or more of the front facade of each building that gets built has to be 10 feet or closer, if it wants to be, to the street.
To the street or to the property line?
Well, to the property line that is the right of way of the street. Right of way is also green buffers, tree panels, sidewalks, so that the 10 feet countdown would start on the outside of all of that and then continue lawnward towards the building.
I know, but if someone wants to put a little bit further back, it's good for noise and also environment. If you have a street has a lot of gas, you want to have people to breathe better, to be able to open their windows and not to have noise or, breathe. The gasoline from the car.
Hi, so my name is Jessica McVary. I'm planning supervisor on behalf of the East County Planning Division and also here on behalf of the University Boulevard Corridor Plan and the Overlay Zone. As Mr. Burbert was mentioning and as we talked about through the review and approval process, or the planning board's review and approval of the University Boulevard Corridor Plan, we really are trying to create an environment along University Boulevard that brings the buildings closer to the street, In order to create that sense of enclosure that Mr. Berbert was mentioning, which also helps to improve safety for everyone, regardless of how you're traveling along the corridor. And if you can, and apologies that we don't have the visuals included in this presentation, if you can recall from our work on the University Boulevard Corridor Plan, the vision for the cross-section of University Boulevard is to have travelways and then dedicated bus lanes along the curb with a planted buffer and a side path facility. And the 10 feet of the maximum build-out area that we're discussing here would sort of start at that side path facility. So you do have quite a bit of distance between the building at this sort of maximum setback area and the actual transitway. You would have the transitway, the buffer, the side path, and then the building with the opportunity to set that building back, to set 70% of that building back 10 feet.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but just I'm imagining that we're going to have the BRT lane at the curb line. So we have these buses, hopefully, that go back and forth frequently. That, and then you want the front of the houses and probably the bedrooms facing the street, that it has some noise and also some, I cannot open the window. So I'm just, I guess that we will see how it works out. This is just my hunch and my personal feeling. No, I don't know. I know Commissioner, the new vice chair, want to say something.
I don't know. I don't know if that's active yet, so I'll stick with Commissioner for now. But I remember we talked about this before. I think we've sort of dealt with some similar comments and concerns. I support the 10-foot build-to area that you're describing, but I just, and this is outside the scope of this conversation, I just wanted to note it again that I think it underscores really the urgency of trying to implement some of the transportation improvements as quickly as possible. There's been, I think, at least two instances on University just in the past half year where a car has gone off the road, crashed into a house. And right now, as you're describing, those houses are 30 feet or more set back from University. The traffic moves so quickly, and the road currently is so unsafe that just in the past half year, two cars have crashed into existing homes. So that's not something that, again, we can directly in this plan, but when we think about sort of the phasing of how this plan rolls out and the recommendation, and I know the plan is currently with council, so maybe I'm speaking more to a different audience here, but we're envisioning a fully built out future where a lot of the benefits that you described do start to accrue, and I think that future also speaks to some of the concerns that Commissioner or Vice Chair Pedwim, still Vice Chair for today, spoke to about, you know, noise, because there will be a larger planted buffer, which does help with noise, with air pollution, with the planted buffer and trees, and slower traffic and maybe less traffic. All those things start to come down or are less concerning in the future. But today, if in the next year or two someone builds a home that is 10 feet from, you know, the build-to line, and I understand that it's not exactly next to the street, in the near term we are bringing homes closer to the street, and we are introducing more noise, because these homes are typically not going to be built to the same standards that more commercial scale developments have, so noise will be a concern for the people living inside, and there will be, you know, some concerns around safety just given how traffic currently moves on the corridor. So these are all the things that I think are still important to note, that the capital improvements on this corridor need to happen as quickly as possible, and the bus lanes need to become permanent, and the space between future developments and the road needs to remain somewhat significant until a future vision is realized. So, you know, I just wanted to highlight that again, because it's easy to sort of imagine, you know, all of the benefits for people moving through the corridor. And there are significant benefits, I think, in the near term for people moving through the corridor and the safety for the people walking and biking and obviously taking the bus, and their travel times will be improved. But the people actually living in the homes in the near term, I think we have to pay a little bit more attention in the future, I think, to that quality of life in the home itself, and understand that like a future build-out scenario may not happen for years for some of the people living in a new home in kind of the beginning phase of this plan rollout.
Majority that wants to keep it as is, though. I just need to make sure what we're transmitting in comments.
Yes, I would recommend keeping it as you have, noting that as what Commissioner Linden said, you know, as we look through. And also, one of the questions I would have, in a C zone, what are the noise requirements with respect to an R zone? Just out of curiosity, would they have to meet the, are there different noise requirements?
So the noise requirements are based off of location, not by zone.
Okay.
And so protect somebody in an open window environment, because right. That obviously lets noise in. But the noise requirements would still apply to the sense that in a closed window environment, they may have to use enhanced building materials on the front facades of these buildings, because they are required to keep the decibel inside below a certain level as part of those standards. And so
regardless of the zone, right? So they would have to meet the 45 interior, and there's some about
the exterior open space is supposed to be mitigated to a higher but mitigated level in this case the backs of the homes.
Perfect.
Because this is now a zoning text amendment and not a proposal, there was a climate assessment done for this. The ZTA itself, we've anticipated to have little to no impact. And we say that because this was already covered by the climate assessment that was actually done for the plan itself. This is implementing what was in that plan, and so we're sort of seeing that it was already covered, the overlay zone and what the provisions in it are what we expected to see, and so there's not like any additional impact. We would have done or said more here if the overlay zone was amended in a way that it maybe changed that initial analysis. From the plan itself, just as a summary, there were sort of minor to moderate, both positive and negative impacts to greenhouse gas emissions. You know, some of the negatives are obviously bringing more people to this plan area. That is going to have a negative impact, very locally anyway, on climate impact, although on the per capita impacts would actually be less, and so that's kind of seen as a positive. And again, this plan, from an adaptive capacity and resiliency standpoint, had lots of positive impacts by connecting more people to more resources and amenities and transit and those sorts of things. So in conclusion, this planning staff is recommending the board transmit to the district council a memo supporting the ZTA with the two revisions that are included. I can also just include a request from the board to keep it on the council's radar that actually implementing some of the physical infrastructure improvements on the corridor itself, we hope to see, you know, top of mind as they go to implement the plan further.
I agree. Okay. So, do I have a? You're all done, Mr. Berbert?
Yes.
Okay, great. So, do I have a? If hearing no other comments or discussion from the board, hearing none, but are there any comments or questions from the board? So, thank you for your presentation.
I do have a comment. Okay. I always enjoy the presentations from Mr. Berbert. They're always well thought out. And some of the questions that I anticipate asking from the material you supply pre-meeting is often answered through your presentation. Thank you.
Yes, so thank you again for your presentation. Thank you, Vice Chair Linden for your comment about the importance of the implementation. So do I have a motion? I'm sorry, please.
Oh, Artie, can. Sorry, Michael. One more comment. I'd like to wish Mr. Berbert a happy birthday.
Oh. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather spend it.
Well, happy birthday, Mr. Berbert. Yeah.
I couldn't let you
happy
get away.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, yeah. So do I have a motion to transmit comments to District Council on the ZTA 25-12 overlay zones, University Boulevard overlay zone, with the additional comment around implementation?
I move to transmit the comments to District Council for ZTA 25-12.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it. Thank you so much. We're just going to take a 2-minute break and finish today with the item number 8, Creekside at Cabin Branch Preliminary Plan Amendment, where staff is recommending approval with conditions. Thank you. Good afternoon. We're on our last item of the day, item number 8, Creekside at Cabin Branch Preliminary Plan Amendment, where staff is recommending approval with conditions. And this afternoon, Philip Estes with the Parks, I mean, with the Planning Department is presenting this item. Sorry.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Philip Estes with Up County Planning. I'm here with the review team for this preliminary plan amendment to modify previously approved conditions. One thing staff does want to note is that after discussions with the applicant has agreed to withdraw the request to amend condition number 11 for today, and that's to allow additional time for further discussions with staff. So for today's amendment request, it is regarding an amendment to condition number 14 to update the DOT approval letter and also to delete condition 26, which is related to the release of building permits and traffic signal. Just to clarify for this application, there's no change in density, the land use, or any other development standard. The applicant has satisfied all the noticing requirements, and the public hearing notice was mailed out by staff. We did receive one comment from a community member who objected to granting the amendment due to vehicular speeding and a fire department access point. Staff has confirmed that the approved fire department access plan provides for both a primary and a secondary access point. The applicant also suggested that the number of dwelling units exceeds what's permitted with one access point. And we confirmed that the project does indeed have two access points. And the approved total unit count is consistent with the approved fire department access plan from September 17th of 2020. The applicant has indicated they're moving forward with the traffic signal design and permitting as expeditiously as possible. And also the applicant has posted a surety bond for the traffic light. So there's no further mitigation or efforts required to address the comment. Familiarize you with this particular subdivision that's shown here, located at the northwest quadrant of Clarksburg Road and West Old Baltimore Road. It's within the 10 Mile Creek area limited master plan amendment and also within the Clarksburg master plan area. It's roughly 400 acres in size and it's currently under development for 118 single family houses and 208 townhouses. Zoning of the property is a rural neighborhood cluster. The surrounding zone consists of commercial, residential town, RE1 and rural, and mentioned to the south, north, and to the west rural. For condition number 14, as shown here, this is just to update the approval letter date for the DOT letter. So this will replace the letter from November 19th of 2020 with a revised letter dated August 29th, 2025. So for condition number 26, the request is to delete this. Condition number 26 primarily was required so that the applicant would be required to perform a signal warrant analysis before the 217th permit, no earlier than the 200th permit. This analysis has been completed and accepted by State Highway. The analysis concluded that indeed a traffic signal installation is warranted at the intersection of Clarksburg Road and Dowager Way. The applicant indicates that the approval process timeline for the signal required by SHA and DOT will not enable them to obtain and install the signal by the 240th building permit as is required by the current condition. Staff and DOT acknowledge the timeline constraints and agree that condition 26 would be satisfied by the revised conditions contained in the updated DOT letter. Approving the amendment will ensure, one, that the installation of the traffic signal occurs, and two, it will no longer unreasonably constrain the applicant's ability to proceed with building out the approved homes in the subdivision. Furthermore, the applicant has posted a surety bond to ensure the installation, which I mentioned has been accepted by SHA. So therefore, with the signal warrant analysis completed, the surety bond posted, and the revised letter, condition 26 is no longer needed because the requirements are now contained within that letter. Therefore, the applicant has met the findings for approval. It conforms to the applicable master plans. Public facilities remain adequate, and the application complies with the applicable provisions of the subdivision code. And staff recommends approval as noted. And this concludes our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Estes, for your presentation. Members of the board have any questions or comments? I'm supportive of the recommendations. Applicant like to make a presentation.
Good afternoon, for the record, Bob Harris. I'm here with Bobby Varner of Pulte. No, I think staff has done an excellent job in summarizing it and working with us, so we agree with their recommendations.
The only question I have is just, do you have a sense now of just out of curiosity, what has been built and what is remaining to be built?
Can you answer that?
Bobby Varner here, for the record. I am director of land planning for Pulte Mid-Atlantic. So I do have our numbers here. When it comes to homes that have actually been constructed and people are living in those homes right now, we have 194 settlements to date out of 326. So we're just at about 60% settled. And, you know, we're actively constructing the balance of the units out there. We've sold 247 to date. So we've sold about 76% of the inventory out there. And we'll be continuing to build the rest of the homes and move people in there as soon as possible. I would probably estimate that we'll be completely sold out probably in the next year, if I had to guess, but just based on the way things are going currently.
Okay, thank you so much. Thanks for that information. So do I have a motion to all of the items in eliminating item number 11. The conditions, the 14 and 26, and condition 11 will not be amended at this time. So we recommend approval of the preliminary plan of those two conditions, but not condition number 11, which will be not be amended at this time.
I move to approve a staff recommendation for the approval of Creekside at Cabin Ranch preliminary plan amendment with conditions.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The ayes have it, 5-0. Thank you so much. Look forward to you building out this community. As we all stated, we need more housing. We have a housing crisis, so thank you. And this ends our planning board meeting for today. Thank you.
Thank you.